The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine, Monday, the 11th of September, 2023. How are you all keeping? I hope you had a good weekend and got the most out of the last of the probably summery type weather we're going to experience. It's really busy around the place. Lots of people still out and about socialising and spending, it seems, anyway. At least in the north of the county. I'm not sure what it was like where you are. But anyway, as I say, I hope you're happy and well this morning. The lines are open for you now to get involved in the conversation, raise your issues, chat about whatever you want to chat about. 086 60 25000, the WhatsApps and texts from outside the Republic. 00353 86 60 25000. If you want to give us a call, Donna Marie and Niamh will help you out there. 074 91 25000. Again, from outside the Republic, 00353 7491 25000. And of course, need I remind you that you can indeed email us from anywhere, comments@highlandradio.com. And of course, watch the show if you wish as well. There, we're there as well. Okay, let's crack on with a look at what's on the front and inside some of the papers today. The Derry People Donegal News, their headline, Money Mule Warning. Students of Donegal ATU have been urged not to act as money mules by criminals in order to launder the proceeds of crime. The fresh warning from the president of the Students' Union, Barry Breslin, came after new figures show nearly $17.5 million was transferred illegally through so-called money mule accounts between January and June of this year. The flow of cash represents an increase of almost 50% on last year. So someone come to you and they'll say, you know, my bank account's frozen or this, that and the other. I think the figure they normally are looking to wash through your accounts around about €10,000. They'll offer you €500 or €1,000 or something along those lines. And they won't just say, look, you're getting involved in some criminality here. They will try and frame it often a different way, but it can have really devastating impacts if you're caught. And you are likely to be caught, we're told by the Gardaí. And it also could inhibit your opportunities to travel for work or for life experiences as well. So if it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. And they do target 18 to 25-year-olds, particularly, it seems. The Derry News this morning, a Derry mother has vowed to take her campaign for mandatory Group B strep testing for all pregnant women in the north to Stormont. Shannon Doherty, whose son Ryan almost died from complications arising from the bacterial infection, is also organising a fundraiser for Aunt Galvin Hospital's Ward 6, where Ryan received life-saving treatment. B strep is bacteria commonly found in the digestive tract, urinary tract and genital area. It rarely causes symptoms or problems in adults, but it can be fatal for newborn babies. I haven't heard that call before for all pregnant women to be tested for Group B strep. I'm not sure when that might happen in their pregnancy, but obviously that's a mum who believes it's really, really important. The Irish Independent today kind of continuing by accident, not intention, a conversation we've been having on this programme for the last couple of weeks, and it's in relation to young people getting access to mental health services, disability network services as well, but their focus is on CAMHS. More than half of the children and teenagers referred to their local child and adolescent mental health services, CAMHS services, are refused access in some parts of the country. Around 4,000 children referred to mental health services this year were not accepted by the HSC, as the overall refusal rate increased by more than 10% in 3 years. Analysis of new data shows the number of children not accepted by the service varies dramatically depending on where they live. Cork and Kerry, the area with the highest waiting lists for children mental health services, also had one of the highest refusal rates. More than half of the almost 1,200 children referred to the service this year were not accepted. Figures compiled by the HSE show that in 2020, around 28% of the 17,436 children and adolescents referred to CAMHS were turned down. Now, presumably, there's a role here for GPs and others in referring younger people for these services. Now, I'm not sure if it's right or wrong that they are being refused. That's where yous come in. I mean, have you had experience of this where a referral to CAMHS services or the CAMHS service was refused? Was it and is it the wrong decision? And maybe you can explain to us as why that decision was made and what it meant. As I say, feel free, please, to help us highlight these issues. 086 60 25,000, the WhatsApp and text number. The Irish Times tells us that road safety lessons for Leaving Cert students are being considered by Minister for Education Norma Foley in the wake of recent deaths involving young people on Irish roads. Ms Foley wrote to the Road Safety Authority last week seeking to explore avenues to enhance road safety education within schools, especially during senior cycle, though I think it should start much earlier. I think the younger ones are very busy in the Leaving Cert, and maybe use the Leaving Cert to reaffirm stuff that's been put into their heads from a much younger age. I struggle to see how a minister thinks that the way to approach this awful situation is to do it in Leaving Cert, because even the best practice now, I would suggest the best practice now is transition year earlier, and then maybe reaffirm it in Leaving Cert. But I think Leaving Cert students have an awful lot on their minds, and it's a bit late at that point. But anyway, I mean, we wouldn't teach our Leaving Cert students, we wouldn't start teaching stuff like recycling, would we, in fifth and sixth class? You start that much younger. Obviously, sex education, they choose to start that at a very young age. Why, when something such a life and death matter, why wait till fifth or sixth year? But anyway, listen, maybe it's something, and maybe you think it's the right time. For me, it's just not well thought through. Reading on here, though, while there are modules on road safety at junior cycle, Ms Foley said measures targeting older students should be considered, given that the group is most likely to be learning to drive. There have been a significant and saddening increase in fatalities on Irish roads in the past year, many of which have tragically involved children and young people, she wrote in a letter to Road Safety Authority Chairman Sam Wade. I'm aware of what they do already, and I just simply don't think it is enough. The much-hated USC could be cut somewhat this year in the budget. Well, certainly it's Budget 2024, of course, that's announced in a few weeks. The Irish Daily Mail tells us that Fianna Fáil and Finance Minister Michael McGrath are perceived to have been the big winners in the pre-budget power game in the wake of revelations that the government intends to prioritise cuts to USC in the budget. As part of its pre-budget process, the government has allocated $1.15 billion for tax cuts, and is now believed to be prioritising significant cuts in USC as its signature tax policy. The hated universal social charge is seen as a Fianna Fáil tax, since it was introduced by the late Fianna Fáil Finance Minister Brian Lenihan as an austerity measure in 2010. Tensions have been high between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael over Fine Gael's attempts to seize control of the tax agenda via Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's campaign for a 30% tax rate. It intensified after a spontaneous article by three Fine Gael ministers of state, which it wasn't spontaneous at all, of course, calling for significant tax cuts of $1,000 a year for middle income earners. So that's what they're working on at the moment. On to the Irish Daily Star this morning. And Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said he does not believe that a legal mask mandate will be reimposed by the Irish government this winter. The HSE warned last month that the number of COVID-19 cases in Ireland was trending upward due to the emergence of the transmissible Eris strain. There were 305 people in hospital with COVID-19 at 8 a.m. on Friday morning. Some 46 new cases were admitted to hospital in the previous 24 hours, with 32 discharges. Again, I don't want to go down this road again. If it's something we have to talk to. But 46 new cases weren't admitted to hospital. 46 people were tested in hospital and had it. Again, this strange way of reporting it seems to continue. The Taoiseach said that there will continue to be waves of COVID-19, but thought it very unlikely mask wearing was to return. He said, we're in a very different phase when it comes to dealing with COVID and also elections. Okay, that's the Star. On to, and I know this is something that comes up time and time again, but when a mother speaks out from the position she does, it's just something I don't want to ignore. A mum whose bullied daughter killed herself has backed a ban on under-15s using social media, declaring our kids are being lost in a virtual world. Aisling O'Neill's daughter, Mia, took her own life aged just 16 after being subjected to a horrible campaign of online bullying. Aisling told the Irish Sun, With my youngest daughter, I'd be delighted if she didn't have a phone, except for contact reasons. I don't want her to have social media. A shocking report, as we mentioned, from Cyber Safety Kids found that one in four primary school children have experienced online bullying, with girls more likely to suffer than boys. But interestingly, in our conversation with a rep from that organisation, he wasn't of the view, or it seems the organisation isn't of the view, that we should have, say, for instance, something as simple as photographical ID to ensure that people are the age that they are. Now, I know there's privacy issues there, but I don't know, maybe we need to talk about that more broadly as well. And finally, in the Daily Mirror, two sports stories here. Rory Gallagher has been temporarily banned from GEA activities 4 months after he quit as Derry football manager over domestic abuse allegations. It was confirmed last night after reports he led a training session this week at Corduff Club in County Monaghan. Ulster GEA said Rory Gallagher has been temporarily debarred without prejudice until the Ulster GEA safeguarding panel conclude their work. The GEA really in reaction mode with a lot of this stuff. And finally, those that wanted Louis Rubiales out have got their way, because Spanish Football Federation President Luis Rubiales has said he is to resign following the controversy over him kissing Jenny Hermosa. He kissed the midfielder on the lips during the trophy presentation following Spain's victory over England in last month's World Cup final, but the player insisted it was not consensual, and she's reported it further up the chain, but he has said, "I'm out," whilst investigations are ongoing. I think he believes he could not continue in that position. That being said, I don't believe he actually apologised or said he was in the wrong. Okay, good morning, Marie, Audrey, and the rest of you watching across our social media. It's great to have you on board. If you want to watch the programme, you can do so on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, where you can also watch on your smart TV, which has the YouTube app, and also your Fire Stick. It's also there as well, or across your mobile devices, laptops, phones and tablets. And we're on Facebook as well. All of Highland's Facebook pages, you can watch the show there as well. All right, we'll be back with our first guests on the programme today very shortly. We're joined on the programme now by Grainne Brennan. Grainne, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
How's everything?
Well, it's as good as can be expected, I suppose.
Hanging in there, I suppose. Your husband,
hanging out there, that's right.
Your husband's not well at the moment. He is sick with colon cancer.
He's sick with, it was head and neck cancer, but it has now spread to the lungs and to the bones, yeah.
Okay. And we're talking now about your experience of the emergency department and interacting with it. Tell us the story, Grainne.
Yeah, so he had just finished chemo, and he got sick and was vomiting a lot, and he had a temperature. So as advised, we rang out to the oncology ward, and they advised us to go out to A&E, which we did, you know. So we live a 40-minute drive from Letterkenny. We live in Godahorock. Michael was very miserable at that stage. He was vomiting a lot. He couldn't take relief, and whatever pain relief he did take, he had vomited it up. He couldn't take fluids, and he was in severe pain, as is the story with bone cancer in particular. So when, I mean, on the oncology ward, the staff nurse told us that she would phone ahead. And so we went out thinking that we would have been dealt with in a, you know, in a reasonable amount of time. So we went and we were seen by the nurse right away, you know, which was fair enough. But the nurse told us that, you know, we weren't going to be seen for hours. She knew it was an emergency, but she said we wouldn't be seen for hours. And she said, when I say hours, I don't mean 3 to 4 hours, I mean 10 hours.
And at this point, your husband's very unwell.
Very unwell.
And I presume you presumed that he would be, maybe there would be some sort of a delay, but he'd be in a hospital bed or on the oncology ward if that was where he needed to be. I mean,
or even
you can't get much. You can't get
doctor,
much. Yeah, know? Exactly. But you can't get, what point I'm trying to make is you can't, like, he's a sick man displaying, you know, obviously very dramatic symptoms. That is an absolute emergency. You would never have imagined, I imagine, that you'd be told that you could be waiting an unspecified amount of hours.
Absolutely not. And the thing is, where was he going to sit? Like, he's a very sick man. He's very prone to picking up infections. And the waiting room was very busy. So she said you could sit in the car, you know, for 10 hours, sit in the car. Now, Michael is in extreme pain, you know. Sitting in a car seat, you know, is very, very uncomfortable for him. And there was no way we could sit in a car for 10 hours. So what we did, we both his sisters were along with me, and we decided to go back in home again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to see how, I mean, we knew he was very sick, but we couldn't wait for 10 hours. So we went in home again. And, you know, every bump and on that road is causing Michael pain. Mm-hmm. And he just begged us just to leave him alone for a few hours. He was that miserable. And eventually we called an ambulance because we thought, well, this is the only way we're going to go get into A&E, you know, at least get in behind the doors sort of thing. So the ambulance arrived and, you know, they tried to give him pain relief. But at this stage, Greg, we were sort of playing, you know, catch up with pain relief because he had missed, you know, he had vomited whatever pain relief he took that evening.
Understood.
And so, you know, he was in severe pain and they just weren't able to get a handle on it. They tried their best or whatever. And so out to A&E again. And, you know, sitting in a chair for hours, you know, until I'd say we were out. We phoned the ambulance to 3:30 in the morning. I'd say we were out in A&E at about, you know, between 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning. And that was us sitting.
And did he was discharged from the ambulance into the care of the hospital.
Then was it
in the ED or was it in that space behind the doors of the ED? Then he sat till 10.
The space where the cubicles are,
is that area okay? Yeah. So he sat there to 10, continued,
so we
in severe pain.
In a cubicle, if you know what I mean. We were kind of lined up.
I know that it's just outside the X-ray room, I think, is in
yes,
that general
that's
area.
Right, yes,
okay.
Yeah.
And he sat there then from 5 till 10. He wasn't seen until 10. Was he given any pain relief overnight at that point, other than what the
I did ask. I phoned the oncology ward again. He was in severe pain. And I said, what am I going to do? You know, and they were like, well, our hands are tied. That's got nothing to do with us. They've got their own nurses and their own doctors. You're going to have to ask them. Mm. So I did. I went up to and they gave him another form of pain relief, but it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't making much impact at all, you know. So the palliative care nurses, I guess, they came on duty at about 9 o'clock, I'm assuming, and they came looking for us. And then, you know, the ball started rolling in terms of getting him pain relief and, you know, and trying to get him a cubicle and all of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, he did get a room.
He did get a room, but not until 6 or 7 o'clock that evening.
Okay.
So he's in that cubicle from 10 or 11 till 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening time. You know,
it was very
uncomfortable.
Yeah, is that a room on? Is that a ward or just a separate room? Sorry, Grania, just so
no.
Know.
You know, one of those cubicles in the
understood.
ED, you know,
right. Okay. With, yeah, I do.
You know, the trolley or whatever in it. Yeah.
And then eventually got onto a ward that evening at 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got onto the oncology ward, yeah.
And we've had a similar story with this before. I'm not sure if your husband was given
a red
of it. Car.
I didn't hear the
you know, apparently there's a red card that's received if you're a cancer patient, and that's supposed to.
That's right, yeah.
But that didn't work for yous at all, of course.
No. Sure, they knew it was an emergency because the oncology nurse, like I said, had phoned out, you know, had phoned ahead of us, told them, explained the situation, you know.
I'm not. It's just I've spoke to a few people off and on air about this, and I'm not attributing this to any individual. I'm attributing to this to the system. But people I've spoken
to system, right.
Yeah, but people I've spoken to in your situation is they felt like the system has given up on him. That he's too sick for the effort. You know, do you have that emotion?
Sorry, say that again, Greg?
That the system has almost given up on him because he is so sick.
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting opposite him and he was in extreme discomfort and it's hard for me to watch that. And you're like, it's beyond your control and it's just such an dignity for him, you know. He's lost so much through cancer already. He's only 43. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that something that's totally avoidable, you know, that's totally avoidable. He needed a drip. He needed an antibiotic. He needed some pain relief. I mean, we shouldn't have to wait hours for that, you know.
And I think part of the problem is being admitted through the ED. I think in the past, and unfortunately we see it with pregnant women as well, having to go through the ED, it's an extra layer of time and people that really is going to end up in oncology anyway, or a pregnant woman's going to end up in on the gynae ward anyway. It's just to group
That's
everyone
exactly
through
what,
these
yeah,
set of doors
yeah.
seems strange, at the very least. Strange yeah. is the only word I can come up with.
Well, yeah, unfamiliar. Like, you know, it just seems to be very disconnected. For, you know, there's no sort of, from what I see, there's no link between the oncology ward and the, you know, there should be a link. Mm. You know, I think all cancer patients, especially those that have an advanced stage of cancer, like Michael, and is in a serious state of suffering, should be seen to, within a reasonable amount of time, I know there's pressure on the system, but within a reasonable amount of time, by like an oncologist or an oncology nurse who has his notes in front of them and knows exactly what his history is, you know, and what's going on with him. I don't think that should be that hard to organise. I think, you know, we need a change of policy here, you know.
And also, I mean, obviously, too, you know, the both of you have worked hard your whole lives, contributed through your taxes and all. And, you know, you kind of do that, or we kind of do that naively, thinking that, you know, when it's needed,
you'll be looked after.
You'll be looked after, yeah.
You think you'll be looked after at your, you know, this is our hour of need. This is our hour of need now. And that is just not good enough. We're not getting our money's worth at all from our taxes, you know, if you want to look at it that way, you know.
I mean, do you worry too about if there's another event convincing Michael that he needs to go to hospital? Because after that experience...
You see, this is it. You know, he's already had that experience. You know, let's say, and, you know, it's inevitable at this point probably that he will get another infection. Mm. And what am I going to do? So I'm the sort of baddie, because I have to make that decision. I have to say, look at Michael, we have to go on T&E again, you know. Mm. I have to sort of inflict that suffering on him, and that's not fair, you know. And sometimes, you know, it would sort of flicker through your head, will I just leave him where he is and see how this goes? Do you know,
that's
isn't
so
it terrible that you're in that dilemma?
It is terrible, Grania, but it's so real, because I've had this conversation with people more than once.
I'm sure you've had.
And it is that, would they be better off not going in, even that when you don't fully know what the consequences of that decision might be? I mean, it's a terrible situation we've found ourselves in here, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And it's
not fair.
Can I just say, Grania, as well, and I recognise it, that it's very, 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 very difficult for you, because, as you say quite rightly, you know, you're seen as the bad person, but you're just trying your absolute best. But you're the middleman, so to speak, and you're the firewall for the HSE to some extent. And it's tough on you. It really is, with everything else that you're going
it
through,
is.
Grania. It really is.
It is. I mean, they just, you know, like the nurse in AED said, well, I was like, well, what should I do? Do you think? And of course, they can't tell you what to do. So they're kind of, well, it's up to you. And everybody says that. Well, it's up to you. Well, it's up to you, you know. And it is up to me. And it's an awful pressure. And there are more people and caregivers like me that are under that same pressure, you know. And it's avoidable. I just think it's so avoidable, you know. It doesn't have to be that way. And
but
I feel that
it's also, Grania, if I'm reading it correctly, it's not like, I'm sorry, tonight's particularly bad, or I'm sorry we've had to introduce this measure because of this, that, or the other. It's almost as if to say, well, this is it. And now the staff have to work in this awful environment as well. But it's not like this is a once-off. There's nothing to suggest that you won't go through all of this again, God forbid, if you need to do this
in two, three, or four weeks.
So it's not like a temporary problem you've stumbled across. You've actually
exactly,
just come face-to-face with the system that we have.
Yeah, I mean, that's my real fear now, Greg, and I'm not one to go on radio stations, but I mean, I just, all that's going through my head at the moment is he's in the oncology ward, but all that's going through my head, what if this happens again and again and again? Mm. You know, how many times might this happen? How many times? And his lifespan has been extreme, like it's shortened, you know, there's no doubt about it. And this is how we're spending our time, you know. His time is too precious to be sitting.
There's another flip side to this as well, because I'm sure you'll probably end up, if not this time, the next time, having the conversation about him being discharged and you not fully satisfied that you won't be back there the following day because he's not ready to be discharged.
Exactly. Yeah, there's that as well. You know.
People do come across that, Grainne.
Yeah, it can happen. I've heard of it, you know. But, yeah, so there's a lot of fear and, you know, not knowing and, you know, and I just think, I mean, I'm not alone here. I know I'm not, because unfortunately cancer is very common, you know. So, I mean, what do we do? You know, I was talking to a nurse about this and she said, like, look, we have to write the letters and we have to write the emails to the management and let them know that we're not happy with this. We want it changed. So I'm kind of calling on, you know, all family members, all caregivers that are going through cancer treatment and, you know, going through similar situations, to write those letters, to write those emails and call for a change of policy. This is not on, you know.
Grainne, listen, stay as strong as you can. It's a tough situation that you're going through, and Michael's such a young man as well. I'm so sorry that you've had that experience, but I appreciate you sharing it, because maybe even conversations like this will make a difference as well, and I'm sure that's your motivation. So best wishes to all of you, Grainne, is all I can say, and I hope Michael gets out soon and is as healthy and pain-free as possible.
Okay, Greg, thank you very much.
Pass on our best wishes, would you please? Thank you. That's Grainne Brennan there from Gorter Hawk. Louise is online too. Louise, sorry for holding you, but as I suppose you can understand, I didn't want to rush Grainne along. It's such an important issue. And
your Not at all. You're fine.
Okay, that's good. Thanks, Grainne. Your experience is dealing with our health system as well. Can you talk us through?
To be honest with you, I just feel like I'm one of the people that shouldn't have been a nanny,
right,
as you were saying, like that. You know, people's been sent to NE. I was sent down for a CT scan. The doctor said they thought that it was vertigo, and he's not sure it is vertigo. And rather than go through private, he says, just go down and sit in NE. I pay private health insurance. I'm working. You know, we're talking about tax and everything else. We all pay our tax. You go down, you pay your €60 in the doctor, and you're sitting from half one on Thursday until midnight. I'd seen a triage nurse, asked, is there any way, you know, I could come back, or is there any other way that I didn't have to go through A&E? Because I could see the other people waiting was in serious pain. But no, I was just told to sit and wait.
And I think your situation was such that you were able to maybe observe around you the experience more, because you weren't there, like, in an absolute emergency. What struck you? No pain. Yeah, what struck you, Louise?
First of all, there was children, there was babies sitting, there was about three newborns sitting waiting. I couldn't get up, like, and I've been speaking to these people as well, because, you know, you've 10 and a half hours sitting there doing nothing. And they were like, we're just waiting to go through to pediatrics. We've been sent through A&E as well. There was a lot of elderly sitting with their feet. One of them was sitting with their foot black. It was obviously, like, he was in serious pain. He wasn't even given as much as the Panadol. There was another young fella, Oisin, he was started in first year, somewhere in Letterkenny, and he was actually at a physiotherapist, and his physio had said, no, you need an x-ray first of all before I even look at you. Mm. He was sitting from 3 o'clock to about 11 o'clock. Turned out he had actually a fracture as well, but the x-ray department was completely jam-blocked. Mm-hmm. There was not even a seat. When I went in at 1:30, there wasn't even a seat for anybody in the room.
And that's after you got the car parked.
That's after I got the... I had a ramper up on the side of a garden bed.
Mm.
I was driving for 30 minutes. There was people I could see people moving the cones to get parked. I'm actually after only having a baby there 6 months ago, and it was the same when going into the maternity for your scans and everything. And I was told just send an email. I got an email address, send an email about the parking because the staff had the same situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's atrocious. It's like a third world system we have in this country.
So we've paediatrics, we've got maternity, we've got cancer patients all going through the ED.
Yeah, and you know, shout out to the staff, like they're doing their damnedest, like, but I don't know what, how we can change it. Like, I'm only back from Australia there. I was there for nearly 5 years. I was in the Northern Territory, and I mean, it was Crocodile Dundee country. And their system, you know, everybody was scowling about how bad their health system is. There's a second to none in my eyes. You know, you go into a doctor's surgery in the middle of nowhere, and you need an X-ray, an MRI, or a CT scan. They have a clinic right next door. You know, you do pay extra for it, but or if you have your health insurance, and you get it back at the end of the year in a way, and you've got your results within the hour.
Yeah.
Whereas we're told,
and
we
you don't
to
even see the you don't see the acute hospital, which is there to deal with the most severe emergencies. You're dealt with all in this sort of multidisciplinary health centre that's not the hospital as such.
Yeah. I left there at midnight there on Thursday. I called the doctors again the following day, and I asked, like, you know, there's absolutely no need for me to be in A&E. Can you not send me private? And the response I got from the doctor was, go back down again on Monday morning at 8 o'clock. There'll be a changeover of doctors because the private, Aphidia and Letterkenny, supposedly there's like a 4-week waiting list.
So, I mean, I have to ask the question, Louise, because it's as obvious as the nose on my face. You moved back from Australia. Are you regretting that?
I'll be honest with you, I'll be back in the morning. We haven't hung up our shoes. Like, I have a lot of friends that's come back and they've left. And, like, I've got a 3-year-old and we have a 6-month-old. And, you know, we have a lot of support here, family support, but I would never rule it out.
Yeah.
No way.
And it's that competing priorities, isn't it? It's the services, the general life, and then, of course, that family unit, which is lovely to have around you.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, Louise, I hope you get sorted. Were you due back in this morning? Did you go?
No, I didn't. Listen, I'd rather just... I'm still not feeling the best. It's just whenever you're walking, you feel drunk, like completely lightheaded. It is dangerous, but I would rather... wait the 4 weeks and have to sit down there again. It's terrible.
Okay. Well, hopefully it's just you need your ear shrinked or something, Louise. I'm not giving medical advice, but hopefully
we can survive it. But okay. I feel so sorry for the other people down there. It's absolutely...
And I know you were listening to Grania there, and I mean, husband's 43 years of age is very, late stage, and has limited time, she said. And the fear of...
And to spend it in a hospital.
Yeah.
You know, to spend that time in a hospital when all she said that he needed was, you know, a drip for some pain relief and stuff.
Some
and,
antibiotics.
You know, it's terrible. Like, I'd love to know, is there anybody we can contact, or is there some sort of a petition, or, you know, is there anything that people can do? Like, I'm not one to come on a radio or anything like that, but something has to change, like.
Yeah, I don't know what we can do. To be honest with you, and again, and we'll reiterate it, Louise, you did already, we're standing with the staff and the doctors and we're not criticising them, we're standing with them and saying, look, we recognise you should not be working in this environment as well. They know that, but I'd like to say it now and again, because people listening in might think, who don't listen regularly, might think we're criticising them, and we know we're not. This is the system that they are struggling to stay sane in. Okay, Louise, as I say, I do hope you feel better soon. It's nothing worse than that. I had a little bit of that myself at one point, and it's not pleasant. So hopefully you get sorted.
Oh, we'll survive it. Thanks,
all right, Louise, take care of yourself. All right, your calls and comments coming in, getting to those after this break. Some of your messages coming in here. Oh, Greg, that poor family with their ED experience. What can we do today to change this dire situation? Are the politicians listening? People say the system needs changing, but where do you even start? It seems it's like trying to turn a huge ship around. The tape of the interview with Grania should be played to all the thinkings the political parties are having this week. Best wishes to Grania and her husband. I hope he's in better form today. And listen, it's very important taxation's looked at, USC. It's very important that if people who are working or even manage to get a pay rise, that they get the benefit of that and they're not taxed to the hilt on it. But that being said, it would be lovely if some of the conversation at these things in were, well, what can we do actually to improve the ED situation? What can we do about services for people in need? But the problem is, as you see, it probably wouldn't make the front of the Irish Independent or the Irish Times, and that's the facts. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be talked about. Right, Barry Bresnan's president of the ATU, Letterkenny Students Union. He's with us now. Barry, how are you getting on?
Great.
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. We talk about this regularly, and I make no apologies about talking it again, because I just hope that maybe someone who's sitting on a bus with their headphones on, or a mum or dad, will pass on the information. Many, particularly students, are getting caught out by the temptation of easy money, in inverted commas, and are being effectively conscripted as money mules. And it's not a hard thing to fall into. Let's just call it as it is.
Yes, absolutely. So agreeing yourself there, simply raising awareness of this issue, because so many people aren't aware of the danger of it all. We have seen 50% increase on it as of last year. I just seen an article there in the paper over the weekend there. So what we've been doing to try and tackle this on our end, we have a contact with Gardaí Síochána, and we had them in multiple occasions there last year, coming in and giving their kind of standpoint of they had dealing with it. We've also had Maureen Crawford, the solicitor up the town there as well. She came in because she herself has come forward, like, this is an issue. Like, I have your students in coming with me here dealing with this, and they simply don't realise the seriousness of it, because like, you can get a criminal record from us here, and then that'll have applications down the line. So even with your studies, you want to take heading off into J1, if you have a criminal record, that makes it a lot more difficult.
And it's a money laundering criminal record as well, which the one thing I'll say that's good that we're talking about it now is, as new students go into college, I remember I interviewed a senior guard in cybersecurity, and I think it was around November or December or sometime, and I says, it was a campaign. I says, well, why don't you run these campaigns when new students are going back into college? Do you know what I mean? Because they're a fresh crop of victims, effectively, for these people. Anyway, so it's great we're talking about it now. Can you talk us through what normally happens, what lines are normally spun, and what's normally offered to particularly students, I suppose, from the perspective of this conversation?
Yeah, so essentially what's going to happen is some people that can be sent into college, as I say, just to be, like I say, almost disguised as students, simply there to recruit. There to, hey, befriend someone, pay grand, usually get a rapport going, and then it's like, hey, Sherlock, I may have this here thing happening. If you don't take care of it, and Sherlock, if your friend asks for help out, chances are you'll say, I sure I'll go on anyway. But just simply being enlisted in the illicit activities, and you don't realize what you're getting yourself into. And Sherlock, it may start off as a once-off job, and then Sherlock, it keeps going from there, and then you're caught, and that's you.
And sometimes they will sort of say, look, my money's, I'm buying a car, my account's been locked or something like that there. Can I lodge the 10 grand into your account and then you withdraw it for me? So, but as the guards say themselves, ignorance is not a defence. If you are found to have been complicit in that, even if they spun you a line, you could still be faced with, the prospect of that conviction.
Yeah, if the evidence is there, there's no two ways about it. But as casual as possible, just as simply that you don't think twice about it. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with here. I'm simply helping out a mate. They need something done. Mate. Yeah, sure. I can see what I can do for them. So yeah, just taking advantage of your innocence in a way.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So just be warned. Quick one while I have you, Barry. What's the buzz with accommodation around Letterkenny and trying to deal with that at the moment?
It's coming out of both angles. Lucky enough, we do have people coming forward from such as yourself, people who get raise awareness of the issue. But like I said, people are still looking for more and more. We had an open there on a Friday week ago. We had people coming across that I want to get on for accommodation with some of my students, and they haven't even sat their mocks yet. People a year ahead of time. Like, but that's just the landscape we're dealing with. But still, people have a room. We're always taking in applications. So, please don't be afraid to give us a shout.
And what Barry's referenced there is the government initiative whereby you can give a room over to a student's old-fashioned digs. People might know it as. And even if you're on... benefits or supports like that there, it doesn't interfere with that. Have you any idea what the shortfall might be, Barry, just off the top of your head? I know it's impossible to get an accurate figure, but I mean, is it hundreds?
I'd say so, easily. I know we've a lot of more people, say, come from the surrounding area and now choosing ATU as a college.
So they can commute home.
So commute home, simply, yeah. So they have a place. Now, it might not have been what they had in mind, but simply that's just what we're doing at the moment. But we're doing the best we can. And if you do have any issues, our number's always here. We're always on the phone. So please do not afraid to give us a shout.
All right. Okay. No harm mentioning that whilst we have it on. We might link that that link from the ATU in case anyone wants more information about helping out with a room. All right, Barry. Thank you very much indeed, Barry Breslin, there, president of the ATU Letterkenny Students Union. Okay. Back to some more of your comments, Greg. I've messaged about Grania and Michael's situation. It's been 3 years since we lost our father and brother to cancer within a 3 month period. This going through the ED policy is scandalous. So. Sorry, Grania, but well done for speaking out. This is not good enough. And just, listener, when you went through this with your father and brother, did they also have to go through ED or was there a different policy in place? If you don't mind, just giving us a buzz back or texting back just so I get a full grasp of the situation. Another caller says, this is ongoing on a daily basis. People in pain morning, noon and night, and our councillors and government are doing nothing. It's a disgrace. Another, everyone should go on strike. The issue has to be addressed. Every business, schools, companies should gather at Letterkenny Hospital and demand change, because what are our very own councillors doing? But I mean, the councillors are on talking about this as well. Again, I'm not, it's not my job to defend councillors, but at the same time, you know, we've got, there are councillors that represent Donegal on the regional health forum, and they go to these regional health forums and they sit down in front of the HSC and they say, this is an absolute dire situation. What are you going to do about the hospital and so on and so forth? Beyond that, they don't have any power to do anything. And I genuinely believe the councillor has standing with the people, could do them more to raise awareness perhaps. But my point is that in terms of what they could actually do in terms of passing a motion, changing legislation, they are powerless to some extent. But maybe it is time that people got together and organised something. And say enough is enough. Stand with the staff down there. You know, I don't think these things don't work if it's a if it's a political party that organise it, because what happens then is that people of a different political party tend not to attend. But maybe now is now the time. Cancer patients should not have to sit in the ED with people with lots of infections. They should be able to get through to on the oncology ward, and it's as simple as that. Can Michael avail of community paramedic instead of the ED, asks another caller. I think Grania will have gone through all of that, but we can certainly pass that on. Nothing has changed since 2007. They were supposed to change this. I had to go through the ED in 2007 when I was a cancer patient. So thank you. That's answered that question. In 2007, a listener was going through the ED. Was it as busy at that time, though? When are people in Donegal taken to the streets? We are the forgotten county. And with our healthcare system, it really shows. Let's make a difference ourselves, because it is clear our government aren't going to do this for us. Greg, I was a cancer patient 4 years ago. I lay in the ED for 16 hours before getting a bed. One of the times I was sent to the ED with high blood pressure, and the triage nurse was going to send me straight home until I mentioned chemo. She didn't even know I had cancer. I personally think they should have a way of knowing this, but also I don't understand why cancer patients have to go through the ED and not straight to oncology. I had to ring oncology for them to tell me, you need to come into hospital. We'll ring through to the ED, but it never made a difference to waiting times. Again, that's another person suggesting that this isn't a particularly new problem. That's 4 years ago, and we had someone 16 years ago in the same boat. That lady is best write to the complaints officer and meet them face to face, not call or email them face to face and demand to see them. I had to do this with my own husband, and the system has to change. I know exactly how she feels. It's disheartening, scary, and to see your husband terminally ill and fading away, I'll never forget it. The staff want us to be there, but they need to be supported by management. And as I say, you know, this is your platform as well. We can make change. We do make change. And if you feel you want to share your story and come on and tell your story, it's not for content purposes, because we've loads of stuff to talk about. It's in terms of, you know, getting the messages out there. A caller says, I'm just sitting open mouthed. My husband was seriously ill last year and it was bad then, but I really fear if he or any of us for that matter needs to go back to hospital. Just so sad. Small wonder people are leaving in their droves. For it was, if I was young or we had papers, I think we'd be out of here too. And that's something I thought I'd never say. That's how some people feel when they have to engage with the health service. And I feel so sorry for Grainne because she's clearly a young person herself as well, and her husband's just 43. And it's tough enough to have to deal with what they're dealing, what they're going through. But that, on top of that, fighting the system for basic healthcare, I mean, we're not really conditioned to be able to cope with that kind of stuff. And it's amazing that she is. Management in the ED is not great. Sat from 3 to 12 next day to get a hand x-ray. I think you also need to make sure they're doing x-rays. I think some people sit there waiting when there's no x-rays actually taking place. Listening to your caller on about the health system, the broken ED, jammed, etc. But we still continue to take people in from other countries. Government are playing a dangerous game with people's health, both our citizens, hospital staff and the refugees. When are they going to manage this properly? The whole thing is going to crash and burn very shortly. See, this is the problem. This is a bit of a, I think I respect your view. It's a bit of a distraction. I mean, how many of the people in the ED are refugees? How many people working in the hospital are from outside the country? I don't think that, I mean, there's certainly pressure on the entire health system, but it's a bit of a pass. We're hearing from people in 2007 waiting for 15 hours to get seen when they had cancer in the ED. So, you know, we don't want to take our eyes off the prize. It sounds like we end up, rather than focusing and talking about what we can fix about health, we're sort of saying, well, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about another thing. And say that that's what's causing the problems, but it's a much bigger historic problem that. But I fully respect your view, but I really think when we start talking about different issues then and blaming it, we really are sort of giving people who make these decisions and have for generations a pass.